Technology from USC. He is managing director of Roderick and Langlois. He teaches family dynamics at a course at Cal State LA, and he's published various and many articles in family and marriage relations. He and his wife have seven teenagers, he told me, they're raising, two bookends, so an 11-year-old and a 21-year-old, so he's got quite a challenge. And we'll turn the time over, and hopefully there'll be time for questions at the end, okay?
The full title of my paper is not the same as is listed on your program. It took me 4 days to think of a cute title, and I'm not going to let you get away with not hearing it. The title is Pregnant with Meaning, An Analysis of the Word Family in LDS Rhetoric. See? The man behind the counter in the video rental store had discovered we were LDS. "So you're Mormons," he exclaimed. "I'd never join your church, but I admire Mormons because they have such great families." Even though he had made the golden question a moot point, I decided I could still arouse his interest in the church by the mention of some provocative doctrine. I had just decided that polygamy seemed too sleazy to be a good lead-in when he launched into a glowing description of Mormon family life. Afterward, my 11-year-old daughter looked puzzled and said, "Gosh, that doesn't sound like us at all." I did two things on the way home. First, I faced the ugly truth that although we were a happy family, we weren't one of those wonderful LDS families that was considered an example. And second, I identified the source of his perceptions about Mormonism. Something about them seemed a little more than the sum of church PR, and that something was an old-fashioned, generally understood, and very romantic vision of the family. Mary E. Stovall, an assistant professor of history at BYU, described it in an essay on the myths and realities of American families. Quote, "The husband is the breadwinner and the wife is the homemaker who devotes herself to home and her numerous children, all of whom are invariably neat, polite, and well-behaved. Under the rosy glow of nostalgia, we picture this nuclear group in a snug, comfortable home surrounded by the homes of loving grandparents and other kin upon whom one could call for aid at any time and who gather for dinner every Sunday and holiday." Close quotes. Clearly, the word family is not an average word if it is able to call forth such a powerful and perennial vision. According to the science of rhetoric, this word is an ultimate term. Such a term is highly persuasive because it assures a speaker of political worthiness and makes one mentally genuflect, as if the mere saying of it ended the discussion. As far as semantic gamesmanship is concerned, the word family is a winner. It keeps company with other words from a sacred lexicon of terms such as America and motherhood, and expressions like equal justice for all. Few people like to stand against one of these darlings of our parlance. A good deal of the power attached to an ultimate term rests upon its connection to a little story, or at least a scene like the one that I have just quoted. Rhetorical critics believe that stories are seductive because they are serious tools for persuasion that come disguised as playthings. They convince us while our guard is down because we think we're being entertained. They can affect us without our knowledge because while they seem to be mere descriptions of events, they are loaded with specifics and decrees. Their cunning lies in the fact that while they seem only descriptive, they are actually prescriptive. This is certainly true of the word family and the way it insists on a specific cast of characters. Marriage and family therapist Mary Beth Raines wrote of the narrowness with which we define what it means to be a family. She pointed out how the term intact referred to an ideal family in which there must necessarily be three ingredients, a husband, wife, and children. A broken family referred to any other combination. She went on to conclude that, quote, "People who are single or divorced or childless often feel disenfranchised," close quotes. The story that lurks behind the word family has more than a specific cast of characters. It also has a specific location, the ideal home. The word home is a splendid companion to the word family because it is also an ultimate term. It, too, is connected to a little story or an abbreviated myth whose plot hints at an idealized set of conditions and which lives within our culture so pervasively that everybody knows it. Victorian writer John Ruskin is known for his description of the romantic dream of home, and his words expressed a paradigm in which the world had two separate spheres, private and public. The central purpose of the home or private sphere was to be an antidote to the corruption of the public sphere or marketplace. Quote, home is a place of peace, the shelter not only from all injury, but from all terror, doubt, and division. Insofar as it is not this, it is not home. So far as the anxieties of life penetrate into it and the outer world is allowed by husband and wife to cross the threshold, it ceases to be home. It is then only a part of the outer world which you have roofed over and lighted fire in. Close quotes. For Ruskin, then, home, like family, is highly prescriptive. It is also paradoxical because even though it is the epitome of safety, it is constantly in jeopardy of being snuffed out by intruding wisps of the outer world. Moreover, Ruskin's definition is so stringent that if it were strictly enforced, most of us would have to admit we were homeless. On the other hand, if home is the complete absence of the marketplace, why is it that all too often only those of us with money are able to have one? If homes are bought, rented, leased, insured, mortgaged, foreclosed on, paid for, or sold, they are hardly the absence of the marketplace. In many ways, they are the marketplace. I submit, therefore, that the ultimate term homes and families reveals some perplexing inconsistencies. And in that case, because we are Mormons who have things called family home evening and family week, who are sealed together as families, who are members of the family church, who have big families, who once a month send out home teachers, and who sing a hymn called Love at Home, it might be worthwhile to get a clearer look at these words to see what they are up to. In January of this year, on a television episode of Coach, starring Craig T. Nelson, millions of Americans laughed at a joke that used the Mormon family as a punchline. The irascible Coach, arguing that his family ought to be happier with its unhappiness, shouted, well, how many families do you know that aren't Mormon? Or how many happy families do you know that aren't Mormon? For Mormonism, this is a very recent phenomenon and signals a change in the way we are perceived by the public. It suggests that in the American mind, the church's familiar image as a family church has recently come into a new focus, or ripened. Curiously, Chia Pets have also recently achieved this status, but I digress. I say ripened because I mean to suggest that the next step is to fall off the tree. After all, to be a joke means to be a little bit laughable, and for our image-conscious church, this is a fall from grace. And why not? Since, as a major shareholder of this ultimate term, Mormonism is not in very glorious company. Everyone wants it. On my television set in San Jose, Channel 2 from Oakland advertises itself as the Family Channel. Channel 8 from Salinas endorses its squeaky clean programming with the slogan, "We're a friend of the family." Half-hour situation comedies have used home or family concepts since television's inception. Today, there's even a syndicated daytime show that just doesn't pull any punches. It just calls itself the Home Show. Neo-romanticism also extends into groups, or the neo-romantic vision of the family also extends into groups that we might find morally repugnant. For example, although good groups have always supported the family because they have something called family values, unfortunately, so do bad ones like the Mafia, the Nazis, or the Ku Klux Klan. Anyone familiar with their rhetoric would tell you that they all identify with strong family values. A KKK pamphlet entitled Ideals of a Klansman might sound hauntingly familiar to most Mormons in the following quotation. Quote, we believe in the protection of our pure womanhood, the home, the church, our public school system, our constitution, and the American way of life. For this, a Klansman must keep himself pure and above reproach. Close quotes. Evidently, then, everyone wants home and family. Even the scum of the earth. Just like anyone, oh gosh, I hope there are no Nazis in here. I just assumed. Just like everyone else, President Bush is attracted to the concept and has used some powerful images of the family in his recent State of the Union address. It is how he employed them that should be of concern to us. Observe, for example, how an American family is used to make a point in the following quotation. Quote, a few days after the war began, I received a telegram from Joanne Spiker, the wife of the first pilot killed in the Gulf. Even in her grief, she wanted me to know that someday when her children were old enough, she would tell them that their father went away to war because it was the right thing to do. Close quotes. Pictured here are elements that harmonize well with society's romantic notion of the family. The father is in the dangerous public sphere as protector and defender. The mother at home with her children is the typical angel mother. She is noble in her affliction and able to find purpose in her tragedy by acting as the preserver of her family's most sacred story. Bush's intention in making the quote is to validate his past decision to declare war on Iraq. However, it is not President Bush who says that Desert Storm was the right thing to do. It was Mrs. Spiker. Nor is she an ordinary speaker, but part of the public's most cherished fantasy. Because of this, her support for Desert Storm is virtually irresistible. War is bloody, violent, and full of horror, but Bush has made us associate it with righteousness and the comforts of home. And in order to do this, he had nothing to say of any substance to excuse war's immoralities, the ironies of American involvement in the Persian Gulf, or wounded Iraqis who had nothing to do with Saddam Hussein's treachery. All he had to do was climb onto the backs of home and family and take an easy ride to persuasion. This technique might be simple and effective. It might unify Americans in a momentary emotional bond. But is it morally sound? Is it proper to divert an audience from complex issues by stunning them into ideological dumbness with their own fantasies? By using the concept of family to help improve its image, has the church done the right thing? Besides, if it is so badly used for public purposes, how private is the private sphere of home and family? This relates to a point made earlier about the ideals of home and family being prescriptive. If we are constantly told how our homes and families ought to be, they are much less private. Magazines filled with pictures of beautiful furniture and elegantly decorated rooms are one kind of invasion that imposes pressure from outside, and there are numerous others. For Latter-day Saints, the rhetoric of church leaders and church magazines advising family home evening, family prayers, proper sex roles, parenting, and how mothers can earn money at home is an attempt to counteract this, to act in antagonism to the materialistic and invasive public sphere. However, even though it is an attempt to make the home more sanctified, it is a similarly intrusive penetration of its private sphere. Temple recommend interviews and their inquiries about sexuality and orthodoxy are equally prescriptive and more intimate insinuations into our private world. They are, however, a form of long-standing religious tradition. Eunuchs for the Kingdom of Heaven, a recent book, chronicles another verbal invasion of domestic privacy, this time perpetuated by the Catholic Church. Its author traces the Catholic Church's obsessive rehashing of the rules for marital sex. At one point, marital sex was defined, rather comically, I think, as something to be done for duty's sake. Cutting through the boundaries of the home, this rhetoric even got inside people's skin with amazingly presumptuous rules and regulations. Sperm was, of course, exalted. The female orgasm was labeled a venial sin, and there was a huge fuss over the proper destiny of seminal fluid. One theologian fretted over whether married couples should show physical affection for fear of causing an unplanned ejaculation. Historically, then, the private sphere has borders that are highly permeable, warped, and elastic. But besides being invaded, such boundaries can also overlap and become confused with other spheres of operation. For example, today in mass media, we are seeing how television news confuses the boundaries between news and entertainment. This has led to a public that is poorly informed and is in severe danger of losing its ability to solve critical problems, which is indeed one of the major concerns of those who study communication studies, is the impoverishment of the American mind because of these things. Contemporary Mormonism's sense of itself as the family church is a product, I believe, of similar confusion over the boundaries between the image of the family that permeates our society like a beautiful dream and the image of the church. The result of this merging is that within the LDS community, both the church and the family have developed identities that are somewhat blurred. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has become perceived as the family church, and Latter-day Saints have become simply LDS families. Because the idealized nuclear family is a cherished myth and therefore smacks of holiness, This overlap of family myth and LDS doctrine is always excused for the problems it causes. No one dares to stand against it because it makes them look bad. Certainly, it is one way of explaining the marginalization of single saints. Since they can be neither Mormon families nor members of a family church, their identity cannot be named within the confines of the church's family-defined identity. Moreover, they have always sensed this and have consistently identified the church's emphasis on family as the source of their invisibility, but to no avail. And what is ironic is that church leaders quite understand why a constant stream of rhetoric on the family would make singles feel invisible. However, because the neo-romantic vision of the family and the church's view of doctrine are indistinguishable because their boundaries overlap, the leaders do not know what to do. They would like to bring singles into fuller fellowship, but when given a choice between diminishing singles or diminishing doctrine, the church leaders feel compelled to err on the side of what they consider doctrine. The result is that in spite of sincere efforts to correct the situation, singles, who now comprise a large part of the church, still feel disenfranchised. Just as an aside, the church tries very hard to deal with this. 2 years ago, they devoted an entire issue of the Ensign to singles, and amusingly, a visiting general authority who was expounding on the family in a neighboring stake last February tried valiantly to balance his family doctrines, quote, against the pain of singles, and the result was his suggestion that, quote, a family might be just one person, close quotes. Although such redefinitions are made in good faith, they lack the authenticity to bring singles the sense of integration they seek. And in a sense, they're a form of denial, a kind of deception. If the overlapping of doctrinal and mythical boundaries in LDS rhetoric has caused problems for singles, it certainly causes problems for churches as a whole. In this paper, I will deal with four of them. The first difficulty for the church as a whole is that neo-romantic notions of the family obscure the meaning of the temple ritual. This ceremony hopes to connect us in an unbroken line with all of our ancestors and descendants, making the whole world our family. To drown the enriching implications of that teaching with an overlay of nuclear family fantasy is to lose much that is plain and precious. The second problem is that we distract members and potential converts from the real issues upon which Joseph Smith founded Mormonism. No matter what cluster of people we perceive of as the basic unit of the church, Joseph's amazing new method of doing theology through continuing revelation was a terrific improvement over biblical and papal infallibility. In theological context, Mormonism is the restoration, not an organization in which we possess the secrets for great family life. This becomes clearer when one remembers that Joseph Smith did not do family the way we do today. His experiment with polygamy was a rather impudent breach of 19th century custom, and I have not found anything that he said or wrote about Mormonism being the family church. The third problem for the church as a whole is that our preoccupation with familism diminishes women. If we didn't idealize the traditional home with such vigor, it would open up a huge realm of possibilities for female empowerment. President Hinckley would not have to imagine heaven in terms of traditional sex roles. He might become aware of more equitable patterns for the distribution of power between the sexes. The priest and priestess model that is preserved in the temple ceremony would become more noticeable for lack of competition. He could feel more able to bring Mother in Heaven out of the private sphere where, trapped in her role as spirit baby machine, we must not pray to her. LDS women who have prayed to her would not have to pay for it by enduring Elder Hinckley's demeaning label, well-meaning but misguided. Like singles, such women are left in the lurch by leaders who have to err on the side of doctrine, but whose doctrine is in error. The fourth problem we face as a church is that our position as the family church in America is simply not family-friendly. Instead, it pressures families to become idealized products on display as examples of the fruits of Mormonism. And as in my case, this can be embarrassing. When that happens, homes and families are not a sanctuary from the corruption of the marketplace. They actually join the marketplace. We call it being an example, but the truth is that only Christ is a worthy example. The following quote, if not exactly applicable, is at least a warning of the subtlety with which one's desire to be an ideal family or an example in a corrupt world can work against the best of intentions. Quote, "The contemporary middle to upper middle class home defended by neo-romantic notions can hardly be said to stand in moral antagonism to the marketplace. It has been too thoroughly colonized. Its ideals do not come from the Bible, but from Madison Avenue, CBS, General Electric, Procter & Gamble. To hold up such homes is not to challenge in however indirect a way the inhumanity of the marketplace, but to defend the material wealth of a particular class and race of people. For all its emphasis on the right to life, neo-romanticism does not have a charitable nod for poor black children or welfare mothers." Close quotes. In other words, to appeal to a corrupt world, one has to look good to that world. This places too much emphasis upon image making, which, of course, is idolatry. This analysis of the word family in LDS rhetoric shows that the Book of Mosiah's admonition to watch our thoughts and our words and our deeds is more insightful than we might realize. The ancient Greeks knew these dangers. Gorgias, the author of the first textbook on rhetoric, believed that he could persuade anyone of anything because words were magical things that could beguile us with their enchantment. Still, I believe that in becoming linked with such a beguiling word as family, the church has been sincere. Stuck in a hostile world that cannot see its beautiful gifts, Mormonism has tried its best to get a foot in the door. It has seemed fine to get an introduction into polite society by developing a close relationship with such a promising little noun. Unfortunately, it appears that the word family is not as virtuous and faithful a companion as we think. The church has been faithful to it, but it has not been faithful to the church. Even now, pregnant with meaning, it is delivering a message that is not the church's message. Last November, in conjunction with National Family Week, the First Presidency of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints issued the following statement. "The strength of any nation lies in the strength of its families. Our Heavenly Father intends that the greatest happiness, the most satisfying aspects of life, the deepest joys, should come in our associations and our concerns one for another as fathers, mothers, and children. Strong family life comes from a perception that each of us is a child of God, born with a divine birthright, with great potential. Strong family life comes of parents who love and respect one another and who teach and nurture their children in the ways of the Lord." Unquote. The Mormons are indeed widely recognized for the value they place on family. In 1964, David O. McKay commented that no other success can compensate for failure in the home. And President Thomas S. Monson recently offered another maxim, "A happy home is but an earlier heaven." President Gordon B. Hinckley also recently asserted the following, quote, "I believe that most marriages in the church are happy, that both husbands and wives in those marriages experience a sense of security and love, of mutual dependence, and an equal sharing of burdens. I am confident that the children in those homes, at least in the vast majority of them, are growing up with a sense of peace and security, knowing that they are appreciated and loved by both of their parents." Close quote. I suspect that most members of families, inside and outside the church, would accept Hinckley's description of a happy marriage as a worthy goal, as they would the various concepts presented in the church's Family Week statement. But how many families, even Mormon families, are achieving these goals? Is Hinckley right in his assumption that the majority are happy? I have my doubts. After acknowledging the high divorce rate in the United States, some sociologists assert that only 1 of 10 couples who remain married is really happy. Charles L. Whitfield, author of Healing the Child Within, reports that from his work with adult children of dysfunctional families, he has come to believe that about 95% of families in this country are troubled, unhealthy, or dysfunctional in some way. Nothing in my lifelong experience in the Mormon community leads me to believe, despite the church's verbal emphasis on family, that Mormon family life substantially differs from the dysfunctional norm. The primary obstacle to our achievement of an earlier heaven is the very family structure advocated by the church.
Patriarchy is not conducive to Mormonism's goal of celestial families. In Mormon Doctrine, Bruce R. McConkie, identifying the patriarchal order as the Lord's system of government, placed the family unit at its center. Yet any discussion of patriarchy in the church must also include a recognition not only of the position of husbands and fathers in families, but also an all-male priesthood and only male hegemony. All three elements are applicable to our discussion of the patriarchal family, if only because they are so interconnected in the thought processes of the members of the church, patriarchs and non-patriarchs alike. Patriarchy, both inside and outside the church, also includes a particular mindset, what feminist Sheila Ruth calls masculism, sometimes called androcentrism. This manner of thinking, which is evidenced in the actions of both women and men, is the mistaking of male perspectives, beliefs, attitudes, standards, values, and perception for all human perception. From that foundation, then, what are the primary components of the patriarchal structure of family advocated by Mormonism? And how are these precepts incompatible with the lofty goals for family espoused by the church? One principle of the patriarchal family is the idea, originating with the biblical account of Adam and Eve, that husbands and fathers preside in their homes, and correspondingly, that women and children submit. As Eve was told, "Thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee." Dean L. Larson of the Presidency of the 70 has explained that every organizational unit must have a presiding officer. God has decreed that in the family organization, the father assumes this role. In an article in the Ensign, H. Burke Peterson of the First Quorum of the 70 similarly stated, "In the order of heaven, the husband has the authority to preside in the home. That issue is not subject to review." In discussing some of the day-to-day dynamics of the presiding-submitting relationship, Mormon wife and mother Afton Day makes the comparison of the role of wife to that of a counselor in a presidency, with the conclusion that the counselor, or the wife, is to assist, counsel with, and give ideas to the president, or the husband, but that in the end, the president is to make the final decision, and the counselor should then support her or him unquestioningly. Another Mormon wife and mother offers this somewhat lengthy, but I think telling example of the presiding and submitting concept at work. Perhaps a wife has a church meeting she is to attend. She wants to go, feels strongly the responsibility to go, intends to go, but her husband tells her he has made a commitment that the couple will attend the temple with the elders' quorum presidency on that same night. First, they discuss the problem. They should pray about it. At this point, the husband who presides should make a decision. But in doing so, he must be very careful. Presiding does not mean that his desires are always the right ones. If he insists she accompany him out of selfish reasons, or because he always assumes that what he has to do is more important than what she has to do, he will be responsible for the decision and for her not attending her meeting. But if, after sincere prayer, he comes to the conclusion that she should be with him at the temple, he should state what he has determined, and then it is her turn to decide. If she refuses to go, she will be responsible. Unquote. Occasionally, the church has attempted to equate the presiding-submitting dichotomy to a relationship of equals. In the Peterson article I referred to earlier, he goes on to assert, "In a family established on a righteous foundation, the relationship of a man and a woman should be one of partnership. A husband should not make decrees. Rather, he should work with his wife until a joint decision palatable to both is developed." Unquote. But Robert L. Backman of the Presidency of the 70 clears up any ambiguity. God is a God of order. He knows that leadership is necessary in all of our relationships to avoid chaos. Since man has the responsibility of priesthood, his must be the final voice to preserve family integrity. Unquote. Patriarchy is not, nor can it ever be defined, as partnership. Accompanying the church's decree that husbands are to preside is its assertion of the proper roles for women and men. "Unto the woman he said, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow in thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children. And unto Adam he said, in the sweat of thy face thou shalt eat bread." From the very beginning, then, was a narrowly defined separation of spheres. In a 1966 Brigham Young Fireside Address, Rodney Turner described the roles of women in three categories: bearing and rearing children, keeping house, and sustaining husbands. President Ezra Taft-Benson's 1987 address to the Mothers in Zion confirmed that the Council of the Church has always been for mothers to spend their full time in the home in caring and rearing for children. In 1987, Benson also outlined two basic responsibilities of every father in Israel. First, you have a sacred responsibility to provide for the material needs of your family. Second, you have a sacred responsibility to provide spiritual leadership. Russell M. Nelson of the Quorum of the Twelve similarly prescribed the assignments of men to hold priesthood responsibilities and, as husbands and fathers, provide for and protect their families. Motherhood is one position, then, and priesthood quite another. Making a home belongs in one arena, making a living somewhere else entirely. Fatherhood as a nurturing role is viewed somewhat ambivalently by the Church. On the one hand, men's roles have been defined to exclude the concept of nurturing. On the other hand, a plan for improving the father's personal relationship with the child is outlined in the ensign. Boyd K. Packer of the Quorum of the Twelve has insisted that there is no task, however menial, connected with the care of babies, the nurturing of children, that is not the priesthood holder's equal obligation, while also insisting that the obligations of motherhood are never ending. The addition of such duties as those which attend ordination to the priesthood, and I assume the addition of such duties as would attend providing for the material needs of the family could be included as well, would constitute an intrusion to, an interruption to, perhaps the avoidance of, that very crucial contribution which only a mother can provide. Unquote. As a mother and a daughter, I sincerely appreciate the Church's occasional efforts to include fathers in the daily lives of their children. Or I would, if I didn't feel so patronized because of the contradictions that maintain the patriarchal separation of spheres. Like the first and second, evidence for a third aspect of the Church's patriarchal family structure appears in the story of Adam and Eve. And God blessed them, and God said unto them, "Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth." Families are considered an essential component of family. Mormon encouragement of large families is reflected in the distinctly high fertility of the state of Utah, where the birth rate is 50% higher than the United States average. Believing children to be our greatest jewels, Ezra Taft Benson has admonished, "Mothers who enjoy good health, have your children and have them early. Do not curtail the number of your children for personal or selfish reasons." Benson goes on to quote Brigham Young, "There are multitudes of pure and holy spirits waiting to take tabernacles. Now what is our duty? To prepare tabernacles for them. It is the duty of every righteous man and woman to prepare tabernacles for all the spirits they can." A 1969 letter of the First Presidency of the Church stated, "Where husband and wife enjoy health and vigor and are free from impurities that would be entailed upon their posterity, it is contrary to the teachings of the Church artificially to curtail or prevent the birth of children. We believe those who practice birth control will reap disappointment by and by." Whether this is still the official position of the Church on birth control, it is not particularly relevant, since the attitudes behind the position, particularly the idea that righteousness can be measured by family size, continue to this day. One of my friends, a working woman in her 30s with 1 8-year-old son, was accosted by a string of Relief Society sisters after her husband was called to be the bishop of their ward. "Now that you're the bishop's wife," the aunt insisted, "don't you think you ought to be having more children?" This pronatalist bias, where having children is taken for granted and not having children must be justified, is a byproduct of what sociologists Mary Ann LaManna and Agnes Riedman call the patriarchal sexual script. Among the assumptions of this script is the belief that the value of sex lies in its procreative potential, resulting in a condemnation of anything the General Handbook of Instructions would label an unholy, unnatural, or improper practice. Of course, an emphasis on procreation also, because of what pregnancy, childbirth, and child rearing entail for women, provides an incentive as well as a means to maintain a separation of men's and women's spheres. A second assumption of the patriarchal sexual script, that men are born with an urgent sex drive and women are sexually passive by nature, perpetuates the notion of a male-female or husband-wife dichotomy. In analyzing these interconnected aspects of the patriarchal family, I have concluded that this structure hinders the achievement of Mormonism's goal of celestial families in many ways. I will focus here on the impact of the patriarchal family structure in three areas: the quality of the spousal relationship, the ability to teach and nurture children, and the level of self-esteem of individual family members. James E. Faust of the Quorum of the Twelve has stated that the most sacred, intimate, and blessed relationship of life is between husband and wife. Defined as relatively open communication on a broad range of topics salient to the lives of each spouse, including substantial empathy of one another's joys, concerns, and problems, intimacy is based on love, as defined by M. Scott Peck in The Road Less Traveled, the will to extend oneself for the purpose of nurturing one's own or another's spiritual growth. Sociologist Janet Chavetz indicates that intimacy requires that partners share common goals and values, that they have sufficient common experiences to be able to empathize with each other, that they care about the same things generally. The separate spheres of the patriarchal family structure impede the formation of a common worldview on which to build an intimate relationship. Feminist psychotherapist Ann Wilson Schaaf has labeled the symbiotic relationship advocated by the church the perfect marriage, and asserts that whole persons cannot tolerate perfect marriages for long. They prefer marriages in which tasks are shared, and who does what is determined more by individual competence and preference than by rigid role definition. Whole persons require relationships in which they are allowed to grow and take risks while nurturing and supporting their partners. The perfect marriage, the American fairy tale, and the Mormon fairy tale, is a refuge for half persons, unquote. Intimacy between whole persons has at least five facets according to Mormon couple Brenton and Margaret Jorgensen, but perhaps the most predictive barometer for marital success and stability is the quality of a couple's physical relationship. Unfortunately, patriarchal attitudes towards physical intimacy can be damaging to the relationship as a whole. In contrast to the patriarchal sexual script is the expressive sexual script, based on the idea that sexuality is basic to the humanness of both women and men, that sexual activity is an important means of enhancing personal communication and intimacy. In fact, sex therapists William Masters and Virginia Johnson argue that good sex is facilitated by a view of sex as something that a man and a woman do together as equals. Power, which can be defined as the ability to exercise one's will, is another important concept in assessing the quality of the spousal relationship. Not only does an imbalance of power between married partners imply that the spouse who is in the less powerful position is less able to express and realize his or her own needs, but also do power disparities discourage an intimacy based on honesty, sharing, and mutual respect. Unfortunately, inherent in the patriarchal family structure is a power imbalance. Under both of two theories of conjugal power, the resource hypothesis and the principle of least interest, the patriarchal family structure puts women at a power disadvantage. Of course, a divine decree that the husband presides in marriage makes any analysis of power theories moot. The imbalance is clear, even mandated, and at the expense of the love, the respect, and the mutuality of celestial marriage. In the extreme, unequal power in marriages manifests itself in the 2 million women who are battered every year. And contemptibly, Mormon women, even those with temple marriages, are not immune to such treatment by their husbands. Even the brethren are aware of the abuses occurring in Mormon families, and I commend their efforts to confront the problem by addressing it in general conference and in the Ensign. I wonder, though, if they have ever considered that their patriarchal family structure perpetuates the problem. Margaret Matlin, in her textbook, The Psychology of Women, asserts that the problem of battered women arises from a situation in society in which males are dominant. In ancient America, King Benjamin emphasized the important roles of parents. And you will not suffer your children that they go hungry or naked, neither will you suffer that they transgress the laws of God and fight and quarrel one with another and serve the devil who is the master of sin. But ye will teach them to walk in the ways of truth and soberness. You will teach them to love one another and to serve one another. Parents indeed have an often responsibility for teaching and nurturing. First, though, I challenge the patriarchal assumption that all families should include children. The decision to have children is a private one to be made by the individuals involved, not by the church. From her analysis of the transition to parenthood, social scientist Alice Rossi asserts that this transition is more difficult than other adult transitions. Among the reasons for Rossi's assertion is the cultural pressure of patriarchy that encourages adults to become parents, even though they may not really want to. On the other hand, being able to make knowledgeable choices about parenthood makes a great difference in people's attitudes about marriage and often in their degree of satisfaction with family life. Rossi further condemns a lack of preparation for parenting. Fantasy often takes the place of realistic training for future parents. Romanticizing leads to disillusionment and often to an emotionally painful cycle of anger, depression, and guilt. In the extreme, as with the husband-wife relationship, abuse in the parent-child relationship results from the failings of the patriarchal structure of the family. Sociologists LaManna and Reedman assert that parental stress and feelings of helplessness play a significant part in child abuse, and they identify the fact that a parent feels under pressure to do a good job, but is often perplexed about how to do it, as one source of that stress. To quote feminist Shirley Rogers Rattle, "The mother who is likely to be a situational child abuser is first ill-prepared for motherhood, one who is traditionally married and in the home all day with one or more young children, and who strives for the perfection held out by the media and the feminine mystique. She lives in a patriarchal pressure cooker with the very real demands of the children and her very unreal and unmet expectations." Unquote. Some child abuse researchers believe that 80% of abusing parents can be helped by intervention programs. The therapeutic approach to combating child abuse involves two interrelated strategies: increasing parents' self-esteem and their knowledge about children, and involving the community in child rearing. "It's time," wrote the editor of The Nation in 1987, "that this country acknowledged that children are society's responsibility, not just their mother's. A church which so heavily preaches the importance of children ought also act for their well-being." The patriarchal family structure also affects the ability of parents to teach and nurture their children because of the rigid roles prescribed for mothers and for fathers. For example, children reap several benefits from a dual-earner family. In addition to the increased financial resources, children may learn responsibility as well as household skills, enhancing their confidence and self-esteem. Girls are particularly likely to benefit from their increased responsibilities and independence, as well as from a more positive image of the possibilities open to women. Additionally, because the research on maternal working status concludes that satisfied mothers, working or not, have the best adjusted children, the limiting of women's options in patriarchy does not appear to be advantageous either to children or to their mothers. Dr. Robert Seenberg reminds us that you can only be a worthwhile model for a child if you feel you are worthwhile. Quote, "A mother before she is anything else must be a person with self-respect, assured of her own worth, and more importantly, must feel she's not paid an inordinate price for motherhood in terms of her personal striving and aspirations." Unquote. Significant, too, is research indicating that the more roles one occupies, the greater chances of being physically healthier, more satisfied with life, and less depressed, hence more willing and able to teach and nurture children. The role of father, as advocated by the church, is perhaps the most significant weakness of the patriarchal system, for all members of the family suffer when a father is largely uninvolved in the day-to-day lives of his children. To quote Alan J. Hawkins, an assistant professor of family sciences at Brigham Young University, "It is true that children can develop into functional adults without fathers, but what we should be aiming for is a higher level. We're talking about creating happier family lives. Clearly, one of the possibilities in involving fathers more is that family life and marriages will be strengthened." Unquote. In one study, fathers who participated in child care preferred shared roles not only because of their enhanced relationships with children, but also because their wives, on the whole, were happier. Hawkins maintains that it is not only beneficial for wives and children to have fathers involved in the home, but also for fathers themselves and for society at large. Michael Lamb, a researcher at the National Institute of Health, separates parental involvement into three categories: engagement, spending time one-on-one interaction with a child; accessibility, doing one thing but being available to a child; and responsibility, being accountable for the child's welfare and care. It's particularly in the realm of responsibility that fathers are failing in their opportunity and obligation to teach and nurture their children,
regardless of whether they are employed. Hawkins concludes, "Are mothers home or are they working? That question deflects where the attention needs to be, and it needs to be focused on fathers. Yet too often, fathers are not even figured into the equation. We still are entrenched in a belief that parenting is a woman's job." Unquote. The issue of self-esteem is an intrinsic part of the processes of developing an intimate and equal spousal relationship and teaching and nurturing children in the ways of the Lord. Although a recent Newsweek cover story derided the benefits of self-esteem, the scriptures maintain that the worth of souls is great in the sight of God. I agree with the Mormon mother who said, "I believe that if I were allowed to give only one thing to my children, I would choose to give them a positive self-concept, a feeling of worth, and self-respect."
According to one analysis, self-esteem has two interrelated aspects. It entails a sense of personal efficacy and a sense of personal worth. It is the conviction that one is competent to live and worthy of living. The patriarchal family structure is significantly lacking in its ability to impart a sense of competence and worthiness to all family members, especially to women and girls. In conclusion, I will refer to exchange theory, a general theory of behavior developed independently by psychologists and sociologists. The basic idea is that whether or not relationships form or continue depends on the rewards and costs they provide for the partners. The basic marital exchange under patriarchy is, of course, related to gender roles. In a more egalitarian, less patriarchal relationship, exchange between partners would no longer depend greatly on practical or economic resources, but would include expressive, affective, sexual, and companionship resources for both partners. To quote sociologist Rosanna Hertz, rather than assuming that the traditional marital exchange between husbands and wives is a necessary element of marital longevity, we might posit that the dissolution of separate spheres ought to give the marital bond a more creative and supportive foundation and encourage those same elements that traditional theories present as essential to marital longevity, unquote. In 1986, Hertz performed an in-depth study of 21 dual-career couples in the Chicago metropolitan area. In these families, husbands and wives both claimed fulfillment from and assigned emotional meaning to an egalitarian dual-career marriage. There was a sense of full partnership, and commitment was perceived as truer. Very visible was the way in which communication was enhanced by similar lives, making possible a higher level of mutual support than in conventional couples, a level that was intimate and empathic. A similar study performed in 1980 by social scientist Linda Haas supports the conclusions of Hertz's study. Haas examined 31 role-sharing married couples in Madison, Wisconsin. Besides benefits to themselves as persons, these partners saw benefits to the family as a whole. For one thing, their greater personal happiness contributed to familial happiness. Beyond that, couples saw diminished female resentment of the male's power, along with increased communication and intimacy. They felt that they had more in common because they had experienced the difficulties of both the marketplace and homemaking. They enjoyed time spent together doing domestic chores, saw improvement in the parent-child relationships because of less stress on the woman and the man's increased contact with the children, and felt greater financial security. In short, Hertz and Haas' research families were achieving many of Mormonism's goals for celestial families. So can we. Of course, the patriarchal church is a microcosm of the wider society, and its character defects reflect those of society. But as Latter-day Saints, are we not a peculiar people? Why should we impede the development of celestial families by reinforcing the patriarchal structure of the family? Adoption of an egalitarian family structure, one incorporating realistic expectations and practical guidelines, one providing for individual choice and flexibility, and for the essential equality of women and men, would be a giant step towards achievement of Mormonism's goals for family, ultimately the greatest happiness and the deepest joys of life.
Well, I can't help but note that if what I'm hearing is correct from the outside of this room, our prayers for the relief from the drought are being answered even as we speak. I congratulate these ladies on their very thoughtful and penetrating analysis. They've given us a great deal of food for thought. I can agree and heartily endorse most of what Sister Farnsworth and Sister Walker have said. The unrealistically idealized family system of which Sonia spoke forms the basic fantasy of the Mormon social system. It is intimidating to many church members. It serves to alienate singles, and it presents an image to the world which is simplistic at best and grossly misleading at worst. That idealized image is the focus of a great deal of depression, anxiety, obsessiveness, unfounded guilt, and demoralization for many sincere and dedicated church members. incest, spousal abuse, infidelity, child abuse, communication breakdowns, value conflicts, and other severe problems are all found in rich abundance in LDS families. Ignoring those problems or pretending they don't exist does not make them go away. Have to just interject here for a moment. It was mentioned that my wife and I have 9 children. It may sound like we're one of the idealized Mormon families that's been talked about, but let me give you a little more detail. This is a second marriage for both my wife and I. We both experienced divorces. Out of those 9 children, 2 of them are away at college. 4 of them live with the other spouses. We have 3 children at home, and we live in a family that's somewhat different than the idealized family we've talked about, even though I would say it's generally a happy family. In Allison's paper, she outlines very competently some of the greatest ills and problems that face the church and its members today. She correctly points out that some experts have suggested that a large majority of all families are in some way dysfunctional. My experience matches hers, that LDS families do not differ fundamentally from that dysfunctional norm. I have worked for many years with both Mormon and non-Mormon families, and I can attest to the fact that there is plenty of pain in both arenas. I can agree and affirm from my own professional experience that much of that pain comes from women submitting to unjust, unreasonable, unrealistic, and abusive demands of men. I can also agree that arbitrary role definitions and separation of gender functions is a great source of frustration and pain for men and women alike. People bearing and attempting to rear children they neither want nor are suited to rear is another severe social ill, as is the lack of true intimacy between spouses. Unfair and unworkable power definition is another area causing untold pain and suffering. And these problems are not something that the Mormon community is immune to, something that we participate in just as the rest of our society does. These papers are both very thoughtful, carefully researched, and well-written, and I might add, nicely presented. They chronicle some of the most serious problems that face modern-day Latter-day Saints. The ills they outline are real, and they are significant. My only objection to the papers at all is a tendency to lay these ills at the feet of the notion of patriarchy or the idealized family. Those tend to become buzzwords that seem to give easy solutions to very, very difficult, complex problems. There's a danger in using buzzwords. There's a danger in thinking that by changing one aspect of something, everything else will turn out wonderful. In a sense, it suggests a form of scapegoating, which may relieve tension, but does not solve problems. It reminds me sort of some of the things that we've heard in the past from arch-conservatives when they used to blame all the evils of the world on the communist conspiracy. Well, now that the communist conspiracy is dead, where are they going to lay the blame for all those evils? When we talk about the patriarchal system or idealized family, those are real problems and problems that are not going to go away simply. But to focus on those and think that by addressing these problems, everything is going to come up beautiful and we're going to have the celestial families that everybody wants, I think is a grave oversimplification. I think there is great opportunity and has been in the Mormon social system for women to contribute. Women do contribute in very significant ways. I think these papers that you've heard today are good examples of that. Women in the church tend to be extremely articulate, knowledgeable, and they speak out on important issues, and I think they all always have. I think the history of the church attests to that. There are many women who I could cite. Let me just mention one or two. All of you are familiar, I'm sure, with Eliza R. Snow. Your familiar also with the fact that Eliza R. Snow had no children. She was a world-renowned leader of women. She had her own agenda. She was not intimidated by the patriarchal order, by the male priesthood. She followed her agenda. She was a powerful, articulate leader of women, and never was intimidated by the patriarchal system or the social situation she was in. I can mention others. Belle Spafford is one that's more up to date. Again, a very, very powerful lady who followed her own agenda, was not intimidated by church hierarchy or by patriarchy or any of these other things. And there are many others that I could cite. My comments would be that if women are to continue the quest for improvement and excellence, and make the rich contributions to Mormon heritage and culture and theological development we so desperately need from them, a redefinition of gender roles is not necessary, nor would it be necessarily useful. The role of females in Mormon society has always been and must continue to be defined not by the male priesthood, but by articulate, capable, independent-minded, and powerfully self-assured Latter-day Saint women. There are no insurmountable obstacles to women continuing that quest and increasing those contributions. Now, they have raised many subjects that I would like to address, but rather than do that, I'd like to open this up and see what your comments are, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you want to address to me, and I'd like to hear what these ladies have to say about your comments also. Thank you very much.
Well, we are fortunate to have about a half an hour, actually, so we could have a pretty lively discussion. Let me put my glasses on here so I can see you again. Okay. So if there's any questions, you want to address it to one of the three panelists or all three, and we'll go ahead and go from there. I guess for the tape purpose, I need to repeat the question. So anybody? 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 The question is, if 96% of us come from dysfunctional families, what is a functional family? Anybody?
I'll address that.
You want to come to the microphone?
Those figures obviously are arbitrary. There is no real definition that I'm aware of a functional family or a dysfunctional family. There are a number of definitions that people have put out. They tend to be operational definitions that apply to certain specific kinds of studies. When you talk about 95% of all families being dysfunctional, I don't know exactly what that means either. But
we all have problems.
That's what I would say, and was just about to say, is that families have problems. Families do not run without problems and without difficulties, and they can be very serious ones. And there are very few families that don't have problems that they have to overcome. That's what I think they're talking about when they talk about dysfunctional families. So it's kind of an intimidating word in some ways, but I don't. I think it just means that families have problems. Okay, I will acknowledge that. I don't know whether you want me to respond to that particularly, but I acknowledge your statement. Thank you.
I can. I'll repeat it for posterity.
I'm questioning this gentleman's knowledge or not able to articulate.
We may never know because you don't see it.
Yeah,
it may be.
A situation where patriarchy is in a foreign system.
Okay, so I don't know if you want to respond, Larry. It's basically she's taking exception with the metaphor about communism versus patriarchy and the fact that women may be articulate and everything else, but because of patriarchy, you they're suppressed in a sense. Is that
okay? The analogy I made with communism was only an analogy of the fact that ultra conservatives tended to lay all ills at the feet of communism. I think there's a danger in that, and I think there's a danger in laying all ills at the feet of patriarchy. What you say is true, and I don't challenge what you say in terms of literature. It most certainly is true that men have had the voice in literature and women have not over the years, and there's great danger in that, and that was pointed out in the papers. What I do point out and what I strongly believe is that women do have a voice in this church, can have a voice in this church, and there needs to be no doctrinal or structural changes to allow that. And I'll give you an example from Eliza R. Snow again. Eliza R. Snow developed the notion of Mother in Heaven. There was no man who ever developed that. That is a well-developed and well-accepted doctrinal tenet in our church today, and it was developed by a woman. It is probably as strong a doctrinal development as I could mention of any president of the church other than Joseph Smith himself. And the notion that that is not open to women, I think, is a distortion. I think it is open to women. I think it's just a matter of women making the most of what's there. Don't get me wrong. I am not fighting against the idea of attacking patriarchal forms where they are repressive. I would not attack that at all. I would say that's very useful and important to do that. What I am saying is that is a very long-term and difficult process, and I think there's plenty of opportunities for women to contribute without that process. That's too big a process to get into, and the idea that there's nothing to contribute unless we do that, I think, is a distortion and something that holds women down. Yes?
Okay, go ahead. But Sonia wanted to make a comment to that. Also, why don't we let her do it, and then we'll come back to your follow-up, okay?
I want to say that I'm kind of happy to have Brother Langlois point out the issue of scapegoating, which is really an important issue when you're seeking to find a solution. And if that is a weakness in my paper, I accept that criticism. What I mean to suggest with the paper to try and meet his requirements more is to suggest that the problem is not so much patriarchy, but the fact that the church is not presently teaching Christian doctrine if it emphasizes family life or patriarchal structure. That perhaps we need to say it in a different way rather than focus on neo-romanticism or to patriarchy, but to simply say we are doing what the temple ceremony warns us about, which is we are teaching the philosophies of men mingled with scripture when we teach patriarchy instead of Christian doctrine and neo-romantic notions of the family instead of Christian doctrine. And I hope that that is at the base of what Dr. Langlois has to say, and I would be I'm happy that he pointed that out.
I'm not sure my bishop would be thrilled I'm here either, but that's a good point. And then you had a...
Well, I had a question. You know, as a parent, guilty when children are raised by someone else.
The question is relative to the guilt of not if both parents, I guess, are working and somebody else is assisting in raising the children. Would one of the panelists, Allison, you want to respond to that?
My first comment would be that what I seek is not so much, and especially, you know, my husband and I don't have a sort of relationship where both of us leave our daughter at 7 o'clock every morning and come home at 5 o'clock every night, and she goes to a daycare all day, and that's not what I'm... That would be as unacceptable to me as being the mandated way things ought to be as the current system. And what I hope for, what I would like, is encouragement to find what's best for us personally as a family and have the encouragement and the help and the acceptance of whatever those personal decisions are, that can be an acceptable means of family. The theory of the exchange theory, whereby if we could do away with that separation of spheres, then individual couples can have some flexibility to arrange that exchange in the way that they think best. And let me make one other comment regarding daycare. I think that in situations where both husband and wife feel they need to be working and their children need to be in a daycare, full-time or part-time or whatever, that the church could have a tremendous opportunity to involve itself in daycare for our children. I'll just leave it at that. You know, I think that there are, in addition to some flexibility, that the church can involve itself in allowing us to make the decisions that are best for us.
I have to add my 2 cents worth. This concept of guilt in terms of families who leave their children in daycare centers is often discussed and certainly felt, and certainly it's the result of an idealization of one way, and I'm sure you realize that. What I wanted to say is that to raise your family the traditional way is idealized, and what is not explained is the fragility of that situation, where you have a system of exchange. The man works in the marketplace bringing home the bacon, and the woman stays home. When the man is killed, run over by a bus on the way home from work, suddenly you have several people in severe jeopardy who don't know where their next meal is coming from. Society is supposed to then step in and take over for the man, and they do so very inadequately, certainly in this country. So why not feel guilty for leaving our families in this very fragile condition? And we don't, of course, because we have idolized this style of life and are not aware of the dangers that are in the separate spheres theory. We leave our women as a whole unprepared to take care of their families very well. Society does not provide daycare. The church does not provide daycare or support systems for women without spouses or with large numbers of children to care for without help, and so on. And this does not go addressed very much because it has a dirty label. It's considered a failure. And I think that's one of the things that Christianity would hope to address in its concern for the widows and the orphans, is a very well-directed bit of advice to re-examine the separate spheres theory and not to idealize it.
Sure. Just to stir the pot a little bit more, you're all aware that the church has urged women to stay home and for the men to be the breadwinners. What you may or may not be aware of is that the church has been a miserable failure in that attempt. Women in the church, the percentage of women in the church with children in the home under 18 who work is higher than the percentage of women outside the church who work. And I think the things that these ladies have pointed out are very relevant things. That this is a problem the church should address and should find some way to address. And I really feel the church has not shown the leadership it should show in this in trying to find some reasonable, meaningful answers to this particular problem. Only a guess. My guess would be is that Mormon women have more children and they need more money.
I just want to make one more comment. What the situation in the church does, whereby there are many, many women who are working who aren't fitting that idealized role, and with the church continuing to mandate that, is that it does a number of things. First of all, it for women who either work out of their homes, teach piano lessons, sew, things like that, then they say they don't have jobs, which I think is a very serious detriment to their self-esteem. It also perpetuates the problem whereby the man's job is more important than the woman's job, because he's the one that's supposed to work and she's the one that's not supposed to work. So if the kids are sick, she's the one that stays home, or all of those kind of things. So if the reality is that Mormon women work, then the whole situation ought to be revised so that we can accept that reality and come up with some practical guidelines or realistic expectations for what that should mean for Mormon families.
I think it was interesting that Orrin Hatch last year wanted to co-author legislation with Senator Kennedy, of all people. I didn't even know they talked. But because he felt like it was such a bad problem, and he said later that he was so alienated by his conservative friends for having had the gall to say something like that, that they it's very interesting. Chris, you always have a comment. I'm surprised. Go ahead. Chris is looking for an answer to if you do change your sort of this traditional role to a different role, will it help? Or is there statistics that show that because they are that way, it hurts? Anybody want to respond to that?
Yeah, I'll respond to that. That has been a very interesting subject, the subject of child abuse among Mormons. There is not a lot of good statistical evidence, but the best evidence we have is that there's no real difference between the Mormon community and the community in general, that the instance of abuse, both physical abuse and sexual abuse, is about the same.
What about
throughout.
The recommend holders? Would that also be true? Are they real active?
I haven't seen any statistics that address that. It would be interesting to see that. Wish somebody would do that study.
The question is that there seems to be a difference between the image that the church portrays out to the world via our media and PR, if you will, and versus what she's heard today in terms of what actually goes on. Does anybody like to talk to that?
I don't want to say how many years. When I was at BYU, I minored in advertising for a while, and our professor, whose name I won't mention, said that he had this terrific idea that he could help more people join the church if we could just get our foot in the door using advertising techniques. And so they took tests and found out, and he said they had done tests to find out what would get the foot in the door. And if you presented the church as a family church, it would get the door open. And then later, that's it. They did that. And my concern for the difference between the fact that we are, quote, the family church and the fact that our real lives are just as messy and regular and goofy as everybody else's life is the laughableness of that contrast. And again, the vulnerability is that every time there's a scandal that has an unsavory quality to it that is associated with the Mormon church, and we have our share like any other group, it is highlighted and made humorous by that unfortunate attempt to get our foot in the door by using the image of family. And I deeply regret that. I think that as a church, in doing so and by buying into this collectively, we have really acted as unbelievers. We have not had faith in the value and the power of the message to stand on its own and to wait patiently for those who can recognize its beauty.
I think we have time for one more question, or we could go eat. I'd like to thank the panelists and everybody in attendance today for your thoughtful questions, and I guess we adjourn until 8 o'clock for the plenary session. Thank you very much. Again, there is information on the Mormon Woman's Forum in the book room.